Take me where the promises are real. Good evening, everyone. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club. Where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
Thanks, Tim. I need to cue. My name's Robert. I'm an alcoholic. And this is the reading that we do for the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language, from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeaker.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, "Yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing." And so now's my chance to introduce tonight's speaker, and I'm really looking forward to hearing what Chris has to say. I've known Chris for a couple of years, saw him come in, and he visited our home group, and for a while he was actually a member of our home group, but he's a member of a group here at NABA now. I'm going to let him tell his own story. But he's the kind of guy that I've been able to work steps with. He's committed to his recovery. He participates in his recovery through service at Intergroup, in his home group, and in other areas. Just got back from a weekend away from his family, but got right back home to his wife and had to talk to me about that. And it was a great thing to hear about because it gives me a chance to think about what I need to be doing with my wife as well. So, with that, I'll give you Chris M.
Wow, what an introduction.
I'm Chris, and I'm an alcoholic. I have a sponsor. Who has a sponsor? I sponsor other men. My sobriety date is May 22nd, 2017, so just a little over 2 years sober now. I'm very grateful to be asked to speak tonight. There was a lot going on. I've been away from my family, as Robert mentioned, for almost 3 weeks. And I was concerned about coming tonight to speak with on top of all that. But, you know, I've learned that when AA asks, I say yes, no matter how inconvenient it is. So here I am. I want to say thank you to those who are out here. I'm actually a bit overwhelmed because I can see more than half of you, I know. And at some point during my sobriety, you've been an inspiration to me, or I've had a conversation with you, or you've been there with a smiling face to greet me. And I'm really grateful for that. And I also want to say to the newcomer who's here for the first time, everybody comes to their first meeting at some point. Everybody you see here has been sober for some time, had their first meeting at some point, and this thing works if you stick with it. So, with that introduction, I shall get started. My story is a little different than a lot of the stories I hear in AA. The reason I say that is I came to AA a number of years ago, and I was thinking maybe I was in the wrong place, because it seemed like everybody who was sharing their story was saying, you know, they were 6 years old and they had a drink or something and they had arrived at that point, you know, and they were off and it was drinking for, you know, from that point forward. And that was not the case with me at all. In fact, my father was an alcoholic, and my mom figured it out pretty quick. When I was about two, she'd had enough and she divorced him. We were living in Mississippi at the time, and she disliked that enough where she moved to Alaska so and got remarried. So anyway, I'd spend my summers with my dad in Mississippi, and he was in the military, so he moved around a bit, so some different places. And I saw, you know, the alcohol effects on him, but, you know, not all the time, just like in the summer. But I knew enough, especially as I was getting a little older, that you know, I didn't want to be like that. I remember one particularly scary time. We were driving home from his work, and he worked like a night job. And he was kind of passing out as he was driving, and we were swerving off the road. And I was, you know, maybe, I don't know, 7 years old or something like that, but it scared the bejesus out of me. And I also remember when I was visiting him too, we had this thing in my house where I always got to take a sip of whatever my parents were drinking, which is Coke or anything else. But he would never let me have a sip of what he was drinking. In fact, he got really mad and would yell at me sometimes, and I didn't understand, you know, what was behind that. So, you know, as I got older, I recognized that drinking too much was a problem, and I did not want to be like that. But then, you know, backing up a little bit to Alaska, growing up there, my mom remarried, and her and my stepfather were pretty popular people in their community, and they'd have parties all the time and have people over, and of course there was alcohol. My mom was all into the, you know, homebrew thing. She didn't do beer, but she did all kinds of liqueurs and other things like that, and strawberry daiquiris and whatever. And she'd let us kids have it. You know, we wouldn't drink a ton of it, but we'd take a couple of sips of this or that or whatever, or a beer or something like that. And I don't remember ever thinking, wow, I like this. It's just, ooh, this tastes good. It's like Kool-Aid or whatever. You know, it was sweet. And if it was too bitter, then I didn't like it at all. So I didn't really care anything about alcohol. Even through high school, when other people were drinking, you know, and talking about how messed up they got the previous day and telling stories about how they got their eyeballs, you know, their eyebrows shaved off and all this other crazy stuff, I wasn't into any of that. In fact, actually, I was talking with one of my friends in the program earlier, right before this meeting, and we were talking about Epicac. Have you guys ever had your parents give you Epicac before? When I was about four, I found my grandmother's pills that she used to put her contacts in to clean them overnight. They came in these little packets. I discovered them and I ate them, and they taste salty. So I ate a couple of them. And my mom gave me Epicac. She said, "Here, honey, this will make you better." Oh my God. I was throwing up for hours and hours and hours and on end. And when I was done throwing up, I continued throwing up nothing. So people would talk about how they got so sick and they were throwing up and stuff, and I was like, that does not sound good at all. I'm not even remotely interested in that. So even when I went to college, I just wasn't interested in alcohol. People would go out to parties and stuff, and I would go, but I would be like, why would you want to drink? I remember when I turned 20, I think it's 21 or is it 18, I don't remember when you're allowed to drink, 21, I went out and bought a beer because I'm like, I'm 21, I'm going to have a beer, and I hate beer. So it was nasty, but I was like, I'm 21, I'm determined to drink this beer. So I shook it until it was flat to try to drink it. And it was still nasty, so I put sugar in it, okay? And I tried to drink it, and I couldn't even finish the whole beer. So why am I telling you all that? I'm telling you that because I believe, in my case, that you don't have to, you know, realize you have a problem with alcohol the very first time you have a drink. If you drink enough alcohol, at some point you will become an alcoholic. And the Big Book talks about that. It says that there's a line that you cross, and once you cross that line, you lose control over your ability to drink or not. And that's what happened with me. So fast forward to really when all this stuff started with alcohol. I was in my early 30s. I'm about 43 now, about to be 44. And, you know, we were starting to drink alcohol. Okay, wait, I'm married at this point, right? So I have a wife and we have friends and we have parties on the weekends and whatever. And we drink some, you know, we have friends over, we have wine, you know, we might have something, some stronger drinks or whatever, but just a little bit of this and that or whatever. It's not really any sort of big deal. But a couple of years into that, my dad, who is an alcoholic, used to live in Mississippi and other places, but we were living here in Georgia, and he ended up moving here to Georgia because of some circumstances. And he was still drinking, and something about seeing him drinking firsthand was very painful for me. I mean, it's interesting because I guess because I didn't, it's a normal thing, I think, for kids as they grow older to kind of like idealize their father. And then as they start kind of getting older, they realize that their dad isn't quite as, you know, perfect as they thought. And they kind of learn over time. And by the time you're 30 or so, you're kind of used to it. In my case, I spent so much time away from him that I kind of missed out on that. So then when he was living close to me, I was still kind of idealizing him. But I would see him in what alcohol was doing to him. So, you know, I had a house at this time, and I had a huge lawn, and it was like a quarter of an acre or something like that, and the bushes would just grow completely out of control. So he would come over sometimes to help me mow the lawn. But, you know, he would come over sometimes he wouldn't come, sometimes he'd be late, but invariably when he would come, there'd be a new bruise, or there would be, he'd lost another job, or there'd be another dent in his car, or something like that. And it was painful to see, because I knew what was happening, and I didn't want to face that, so I wouldn't usually ask him. But when I would, of course, he would make up an excuse, and he would lie to me. And I confronted him about that at some point. I'm like, Dad, I'm not stupid. I know what's going on. In fact, I remember I told him, I know what's going on. If you need to drink, just drink. You don't have to make an excuse. Just say, I can't make it. Don't have to make an excuse. But he would continue making these excuses. It had to be hard for him thinking about that in retrospect. But okay, why am I telling you that? I'm telling you that because it's around that time when I discovered that alcohol would make me feel better. So my dad is drinking, and it's negatively affecting his life, and that's causing me pain, and I'm realizing that drinking makes that pain go away. Isn't that crazy? So, again, we're having friends over. There's the wine. My wife usually buys, well, she does the grocery shopping, so she's actually buying the wine and stuff. And I'm going through, you know, in short order, going through like a case a week or something like that. And she's just buying more. She's not even asking any questions or anything. She's just replenishing the wine supply. I don't know if she's like, he's thirsty or something. I don't know. But she didn't question it. And I didn't question it either. I mean, I wasn't thinking, oh, wow, I'm drinking this. It's just like some kind of subconscious thing. I wasn't thinking about it at all. I was, you know, just drinking. So, and the other bit about that, too, I didn't really have any consequences from the drinking because I'm in IT and I work from home. And my wife and I, at least at this point in our marriage, it was not a good situation for me to drive because we both have strong feelings and opinions about how driving should be done. And when she's driving, I have the ability to suppress my thoughts. When I'm driving, she does not. So we basically agreed fairly early on she was going to do all the driving. So I'm in IT. I'm working from home. I'm kind of a project worker, which means they give me a project to do and I disappear for 3 months. And then when I'm done, I say, hey, the project's done. So I don't even have to talk on the phone or anything like that. I don't have to drive anywhere. So I can drink all I want. No consequences. And I loved it, honestly, because it's a great thing. It really made me feel better. And I'm a coder. For some reason, I don't know who it is that says that, you know, that whenever you're under the influence of alcohol, drugs, or whatever, it can be like a creative thing. And it was for me, actually. I wrote a lot of fantastic code while I was drunk. I didn't remember writing it afterwards, but I looked at it when I was done. I was like, wow, this is awesome. Yeah, I'm drinking this stuff, and I don't really have any consequences. But soon enough, wine isn't cutting it anymore. And I remember going into, it was actually Tower Liquor Store up on Buford Highway, and I was talking to this guy about wines or whatever, and he said, have you ever thought about vodka? Which is weird, right? And I was like, yeah, I've had vodka before, you know, but it's kind of expensive, because whenever I would drink vodka, I'd drink like Grey Goose or something like that, because I'm fancy that way. But he's like, there's this stuff called Taka, which is really cheap, and it tastes great. And I was like, okay, I'll try it. I loved it. Okay? I loved it. I mean, I didn't like it straight. I'd either have to put it in the freezer and drink it so it didn't taste like much, or I'd mix it with Pepsi or something. But it was great. It's cheap. Did the job. So I started hiding that right away, right? I'd buy pints, and in my office I had this little couch, and I'd like put one of the pillow on my couch because my wife never came to my office. I'd put one or two in the trash can because my wife would never take the trash out, and other places like that. And I even, but what's funny about that is I did that for a number of years, and my wife never once found any of that stuff. Yet, my hiding places got more and more complicated. At one point, this is crazy. At one point, I had a vodka bottle tied to a rope over a branch in the property on the, you know, next to my house. That I would, you know, I mean. Can't explain that craziness. I'm drinking a lot. There's really not much in terms of consequences, except stuff starts happening. Like my wife comes home from work and she finds me passed out on the floor in the bathroom, and she's like, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, yeah, I'm just tired, or whatever. And she has no, guys, I'm telling you, she has no idea. She really has no idea. She doesn't know, really, until much, much later that there's anything wrong. She's just, you know. So, I'm kind of like, maybe this alcohol thing's a problem. Maybe I should try to back off this a little bit. And I tried, you know, a couple of times. I wasn't really very successful. Then my dad ended up dying from alcoholism, you know. And it progressed, you know. It, like I said, it started with the bruises and the ding cars and stuff like that and losing jobs. But eventually, my stepmother, he was living with her. She kicked him out, and he lived in a really terrible part of town. It's a crappy apartment in the basement. The AC and the heater didn't even work, I don't think. And, you know, vodka bottles and all this other crap everywhere. And then he died. And I got to see him, you know, the last couple of days before he died. He was over at Emory Hospital here on Claremont Road, which is close to this clubhouse, and they have a club. As it was happening, things kind of happened for a reason, I guess. I was actually doing some contract work for the VA at the time, and I was working two floors down from where my father was, you know, right before he died. So I got to, you know, the thing is that he had hurt me so much. Actually, at some point I decided to cut my relationship off with him because it was too painful to even talk to him. Because when I would talk to him on the phone, it would be one lie after another or whatever, and it just hurt too much. So if I hadn't have been in the hospital doing that other work, I don't think I would have even talked to him. But I did. I went up to see him, you know, and I saw him a couple of times. And my uncle, who's an Al-Anon, suggested to me, nobody knows I'm drinking or anything, but he suggested to me that I write him a letter or something to, you know, say my goodbyes and make my peace and stuff. That was too difficult for me. So the closest I could get for that was that my uncle wrote a letter to him. And I read the letter to him. And, it was, I'm glad that I was able to at least do that. But, you know, I was talking about this idol, you know, idolizing of your father and whatever, but when you see your dad in a hospital bed, knowing that he consciously made decisions to put himself there, seeing him hooked up to all the machines and, you know, the biggest thing for me is they had pads on his legs. And the pads are basically because, I guess, you know, your liver's not functioning anymore and your blood's not flowing or whatever, so they have to squeeze your legs to kind of keep the blood up in your abdomen so you can stay alive. Wow, I mean, what a crappy way to go, really. And you would think that, seeing that, I would say, this alcohol thing's a problem. But, nope. I drank much, much more. And why? I think why, retrospectively, is that alcohol was my solution. That was a very, very painful experience, and it continued to be more and more painful, and I needed more and more alcohol to drown it out. So he eventually passed. And I know I'm drinking, and in the meantime, my wife gets pregnant, which is fantastic because actually we'd been already married for quite a number of years at that point, and we'd been trying for like 2 years or something, and we'd been just go see doctors, you know, to find out what's going on or whatever. But she ended up getting pregnant. I was very happy about that, and I said, okay, I'm going to stop. And I tried, but, you know, I'd stop for a day or two or a week or maybe a couple of months. But the thing is that something would happen, whatever it was. My wife and I would have an argument, or something would happen at work or whatever, and that restlessness, irritable, and discontent they talk about in the big book would come. And I didn't have any way of dealing with that other than drinking. So I'd go crazy. I just had to have a drink. I mean, that's the only way I could survive. So I would drink again, you know. And then I'd do the line in the sand another time. You know, I said, all right, well, when the baby comes, I'll stop. And my son came. I didn't stop. And then I said, okay, we bought a new house. And I said, okay, we buy the new house. I'm not going to stop. I'm not going to have a drink in our new house. It's like a week after we bought the new house, I was drinking in it already. And there's some pretty terrible stuff that happened while I was drinking. Because I mentioned I work from home. My wife works actually in the office. So I was my wife stayed home for some time to raise our child the first couple of months. But after that, I was the primary caregiver during the day. And when I was very hungover one time, I was changing him on the changing station, and he fell off the changing station onto a hardwood floor, you know, from about that height. And I was terrified that he might have brain damage or something. And of course, my wife was completely freaking out. And several things like that happened. But did I stop drinking? No. I tried. I couldn't. So when I got to the new house, this is when I was really drinking every day. I don't even know how much I was drinking because I wouldn't remember. So what would usually happen would be like each day I'd say, okay, I know I have to take care of my son. So if I get up at 6 o'clock and he wakes up at 9, if I drink like an ounce and a half, then it'll be out of my system by the time he wakes up or whatever. So I would actually measure out the ounces and try to work around the schedule of when I was responsible for my child. But it would never work, right? I mean, sometimes it worked. Sometimes I would be able to do that. But usually what would happen is I'd have a couple of ounces and then I just couldn't stand it. I had to have more. I'd just be like, a little bit more. I'm not quite there yet. I need a little bit more. And I'd have a little bit more. And at some point, it was just like, ah, fuck it, you know? And usually what would happen is in order to try to, you know, minimize it, I would go buy a pint or something and say, okay, I'm only going to have this pint. But then when the pint was out and I was good and drunk, I would go buy another one and not even remember doing it. And a lot of this I did with my kid in the car. I mean, from when he was days old until he was years old. Almost every day. I never got a DUI. I never got into an accident. I do not know how. I really don't know how. You know, I deserve to have 1,500 DUIs or more. I don't even know what the number is, but a lot of them. So... And then one time, too, so let me fast forward a little bit more. It was shortly after my son was born. I think he wasn't even a year old. And my stepfather that I grew up with in Alaska, for all intents and purposes, my dad, because he's the one I spent the most time with growing up, actually killed himself. And as difficult as it was to see my dad, my actual biological father, die, dealing with my stepfather killing himself was extremely, extremely difficult. I went into a very deep depression, and I was drinking a lot. And I was so sad and so dysfunctional, basically, unable to function. I went to my doctor, and I said, I'm sad all the time. I don't know what to do. And he said, well, you should take lorazepam, which is benzodiazepine, which you should not take when you're drinking. So I don't remember how long I took it. It might have been a week or 2 weeks or something like that. But basically that entire time I was in a blackout. My wife actually told me she had to lift my head out of some like moduchan soup because I'd passed out in the soup, you know? And then another time too, I had this baby Bjorn thing that, you know, you strap on and you can put your baby in it and walk around with him. So I would take him and I'd put him in that and we would go for a walk, you know, my wife and I and our son together. But one of those times when I was on that lorazepam and drinking in a total blackout, I took my child for a walk. And I walked on a very busy street and we came back okay. We came back okay. The only reason I know about this is because my wife told me when she opened the door, she saw me there drooling out the side of my mouth. And said, you know, where have you been? What are you doing? And I was like, or whatever. I mean, holy cow. I have no idea how my son is alive today or I'm alive today with all that kind of stuff that happened. So I said, all right, shortly after that, I need to do something about this. And this is where I tell you about, you know, AA. I was going to AA. and I was going to the rooms, and everyone was talking about how they were, you know, they drank the first time and then they were done. And I was like, I must be in the wrong place. You know, that's the way my dad appeared to be, but I can stop for a while if I want to. So maybe I'm making too much of a big deal about this thing. And I don't know, I got a sponsor, and I think I was sober like a month or something like that. And then I went back out again for some trivial reason, I don't know. And then I said, again, you know, this is getting serious, I need to do something. And I checked myself into Peachford for detox. And I was afraid about it going on my medical record and causing problems, so I decided to write them a check in advance for my stay, which was extremely stupid. I mean, they will keep you until the last cent is spent. Okay? God. But, you know, I made sure I got myself good and drunk before I went there. So I wasn't necessarily in my best decision-making state. But, you know, I had seen on TV these recovery centers that, like, I don't know, that Hollywood stars and stuff went into. So I imagined it was something like where you got your own private room and, you know, someone came in to tend with you and then you wore, like, a robe and went to, like, you know, a sauna and all this. That's what I thought it was, really. So, you know, I'm IT, and I work from home. I brought my computer and all this other stuff. I figured, you know, I'll just work from home from this place while I recover. No, they immediately confiscated all that stuff. And then I remember the first night I was there, like, all the stuff was gone, and it became obvious to me they weren't going to let me leave or anything. And I'm like, but you don't understand. I'm not supposed to be here. I checked myself in, okay? But, yeah, they kept me, and That was such a horrible experience for me. I've never been in any prisons or jail or anything like that, but I'm the kind of guy who would just, you know, be destroyed by something like that. And, you know, being in recovery was really bad for me. I mean, I had my life threatened while I was in there too, which had been the first time that ever happened before. I had this roommate who was they do this light check first off, where they come in like every couple hours and they flash a flashlight in your eye to make sure you're still alive, you know, because it's that serious. So I wasn't getting sleep, and I had this roommate who would snore, like, I mean, really loud all night. So I wasn't getting sleep. So I went out to, like, this common area where they had some chairs to try to sleep across the chairs, and there was some guy there, and he's like, fuck off or I'm going to shake your ass! You know, I was like, oh, God! So I went back, with my roommate. I mean, that was preferable to death for sure. So, you know, I remember being on the phone with my wife, and I was saying, God, get me out of here, get me out of here. Every time I'd, you know, get a chance to call her. So she was terrified, too. I was telling her all this crap that was happening while I was in there. And she was coming in and trying to convince them to let me out and whatever. Anyway, so eventually I got out, and I was scared straight at this point, right? I went to AA again, and I managed to stay sober this time for 9 months. And I had every intention in the world of never drinking again. But one day, I decided to drink again. And here's how that happened. It's very weird. I went and bought a quart, of course, because that's what I do. I don't want to drink too much. And I got a shot glass, and I measured out an ounce, and I put it on my table and my desk. And I spent like an hour making out with this glass of vodka before actually drinking it. What I mean is I looked at it, and I smelled it, and I'd like pick it up and look at it. And I, you know, but I wouldn't actually drink it until like an hour later. And then I went, choop, and it was on again, you know, and it was another 6 years, you know, another 6 years. Now, during those 6 years, the consequences started getting, you know, I never really had a lot of the extreme circumstances you hear about it in here. But the circumstances were kind of getting higher and higher, where I was starting to have some issues at work. And, of course, my wife knew what was going on at this point, and she was threatening to leave me. You know, my son was starting to realize that something wasn't quite right. And I remember I was in our master bedroom laying there and thinking about my life, and I realized that I'd heard it before, and I believe it, the alcoholic's path to progression is progressive and known. What I mean is, if you start drinking and you say, oh, you know, I've got time, you're fooling yourself, because it is a known pattern. It basically happens to everybody. If you either die, you know, before you get to the end, or you go through all the stuff that we all go through. And I saw that because I'd seen it in my dad. And I knew that that was the same path I was on. And I was not willing to live that path. So I decided, either I'm going to kill myself or I'm going to do AA for real. And the very next day, the very next evening, actually, I came here in this room, 8 o'clock p.m. on Sunday. And I went up to the front of the room and I said, I need a sponsor! And I got one. And there was two guys. And it's funny. I mean, I'm desperate, right? I'm at the point where I'm deciding whether I'm going to live or not, basically. And there's the two guys that offer to be my sponsor. And I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. So, you know, I'm sitting here trying to, I'm like, I kind of like this guy, but this guy seems nice too, you know. So, anyway, I eventually ended up picking the guy that I felt was better. And we went out to, there's a gazebo outside here, so we went out to the gazebo and we started talking. And I told him all the reasons why AA, all the problems I had with AA. And I didn't do that because I was telling him off. I did that because I was telling him, I want to work past this stuff because I don't care. I don't know how to stop drinking. You guys have this figured out. So you tell me what to do. He said, don't worry about it. You know, I'll agree to be your temporary sponsor, he said. And we'll work this thing together. And he called his wife, you know, and said, hey, honey, I'm going to be late. I'm talking to a guy. And we sat out there talking for quite a while. And the poor guy, I tell you, because it was rough for me in the beginning, as it is for many of us. I mean, I was crazy, clearly. I called him every day. Every day. Even when we were going on vacation, I called him from the Caribbean, you know. And it was crazy, too, because we didn't have phone service. All I had was a phone on this crappy, like, voice over IP application on my phone. And the only place it would work was, like, right under this light in, like, the middle of this hotel complex we were in. So I was, like, standing out there at this light, like, can you hear me? Can you hear me? Talking to my sponsor because I needed that. God, it was so crazy. I recognized that I could not think for myself properly. I could not make good decisions. So I delegated all of that to my sponsor. So whatever he said to do, I just did it. Now, every now and again, I'd have some kind of reservation, but I'd be like, okay, and then do whatever he said, because I didn't want to drink anymore. I wanted to be sober. I wanted to be done with this thing. I mean, I did this completely unreservedly because I did not want there to be any chance of any little uncovered corner or something that might come back and bite me later. I want it to be done and done with this drinking thing. So we went through the steps together and, you know, we met and went through the big book and everything like that. And we worked through a lot of stuff. I mean, one of the big things was God. So I mentioned I had a stepfather. Him and I were not close. That's an understatement. He was physically abusive to me and my brothers and sisters, and it was a pretty horrific childhood. Basically, we lived in terror most of our childhood. And he was a man of influence in the community. And the reason I say that is that there's a number of times that these incidents spilled over and authorities found out, or, you know, school officials found out or something, and he would just squash it, you know? He was untouchable. In fact, this one time, I was going to church school. I went to the church school. I was maybe 9, and I was crying hysterically. And normally I wouldn't do that because he'd always threaten us. You know, he'd say, if you tell anybody about this, you know, blah, 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 insert your threat here. So we wouldn't, you know, me and my brothers and sisters, we wouldn't say anything. But this time it was just so out of control, I couldn't keep it in, and I just started crying uncontrollably. So they called me into the principal's office and they asked me what happened. And I told him, and this happened to be at the same church we went to. It was a church school. So I didn't hear anything about it until that evening. My mom said, did you say something to the school about your dad? And I said, yes. And that was the end of that conversation. And then Sunday, when we were at church, he wrote a nice big fat check and put it into the plate they were passing around. That was the end of that. So yeah, not a very good childhood. Yeah, that was hard. So, when it came time, okay, so there was another time too that happened where I was at my friend's church. My friend was a very religious person, and his parents were too. And there was a church service, and they said, "Are there any prayer requests?" And I raised my hand, and I said, "You know, I'd like to pray that my dad stops hitting us, my brothers and sisters." Same thing, got squashed. So, needless to say, by the time I was in my 30s, I freaking hated God. Or anything, anybody who said anything about God, or the J word, or anything. If you mentioned anything like that, you were instantly on the stupid list, and I wanted to have nothing to do with you. Okay? So I came in here, and I saw that there was God up there on the board with the steps, and I was like, "Oh, you've got to be kidding me." But fortunately, my sponsor, if you read the big book, I mean, this program really makes it easy, no matter where you are with God or not with God. And the way that it's worked for me is to take the action that's been prescribed. In other words, I'm a scientific kind of guy, right? I treat it like an experiment. The steps tell you do A, B, C, D in this order. I do that. And then, you know, at the end of the experiment, you get your result, and you look at the result and you evaluate whether it worked or not, and you make adjustments along the way. So that's the way I've looked at it. And that's working for me. It's worked for 2 years. You know, I have no idea what God is or isn't. I've gotten to the point now where it doesn't completely piss me off when someone talks about God. I don't hate church people. In fact, when I see someone going to church, they tell me about it. I'm like, yeah. I'm really glad you have something that's working for you. And I mean it. You know, I'm okay with that. Now, the J word, I'm still having issues with. But I'll get there eventually, you know. I don't know if I'll ever go to church. That's, you know, we'll see how that goes. But my point is, if you have issues with the God thing, it doesn't have to be that complicated. It doesn't have to be the God of your childhood. I have no idea what God is or isn't. But I do know that when I follow the steps, as they're outlined in the big book, this thing works. And I'm able not to drink. But not only am I able not to drink, a lot of things in my life have gotten better. What do I mean by that? I mean, one of the things that was happening with me, even before I started drinking, is I was always thinking about what I had done or what I needed to do. It was like life was just flying by. I would be in the park with my wife and my son. Beautiful day, trees, birds, you know, chirping, all that other stuff, and I'm thinking about what I have to do at work, right? And my son's trying to talk to me, and I'm getting annoyed with him because I'm trying to have these thoughts about things, and he's interrupting my thoughts. Something about turning things over to the God of my understanding and praying and you know, letting all that stuff go allows me most days, most of the time, to be here where I am right now. And connect with you. And I can't tell you what an amazing transformation that has been for me. I feel much more connected with people in this world and my wife and my son and my mom than I've ever felt in my life. And, you know, I didn't expect that. And who knows? I mean, I don't know that you'll get that if you do this thing right away or whatever. But I do know it works for stopping drinking, you know. So, but I do also believe that it's important to get a sponsor and to do what your sponsor says. I've sponsored people before, too, and it's amazing. I mean, guys will say to me, "Chris, I have to stop drinking. Tell me what to do." And I'll tell them what to do, and they'll argue with me. But I can't do that because on Tuesdays I've got, you know, blah, 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 whatever. I'm like, I thought you just said... It doesn't work. It just, from what I've seen, it doesn't work. You either have to abandon everything and give yourself fully to this, or, you know, there's no point in even really trying, I don't think. Now, I'll also say about the God thing, too. It was obvious to me early on that turning my will and my life over to God would be something I'd also have to do unreservedly. and that was terrifying. And I'll tell you why. Because I didn't know what that would look like. I remember it was actually, I was at a 1:30 meeting over in this room over here when this thought came to me. I thought that that would maybe be, you know, me selling all my worldly possessions and leaving my wife and son and traveling the earth, you know, roaming the earth looking for alcoholics and, you know, trying to save them or whatever. I mean, but I think it was important for me to think that because it allowed me to think through all the things that I was afraid of losing and all the things that I might say, well, maybe I'll drink if I lose my wife. Maybe I'll drink if my son dies. It allowed me to go through all of those and let them all go. I let them all go. So then I wasn't afraid, really. I said, you know, God, if you allow me to be sober, I'll do whatever, you know, whatever. I'll let go of whatever. Because I'm no good to my wife or my son or anybody else, you know, if I'm drinking. So, anyway, I think I'm getting close to the end of time. So what does it look like today for me? I mean, so what does my life look like today? So what is actually God's will for me today? What's really awesome about that, what it looks like is me being a good husband and a good father, a good employee, a good son, a good friend, a good AA member. That's what it looks like. My life basically looks the same as it did before, but I'm doing some stuff to help some people on the side and being a better person. So it's not this dramatic, you know, change of life. You know, it's much better than I could ever have hoped for. And one of the cool things about it, too, is because I'm in IT, there's some needs that AA has for IT, and I've been able to be helpful to AA using that stuff. I mean, again, I'm sitting here thinking I have to pull people out of the gutter and help them, but I'm actually over here working on spreadsheets and Google Maps and stuff like that for AA. That's cool. Anyway, so, guys, if you want to get sober, this thing works, but you got to do it. You got to do it wholeheartedly. Get a sponsor. Work the steps, and you can be sober too. Thanks.
Thank you, Chris. Super. You really delivered. We appreciate you. And Carrie's going to give out the chips.
Thanks, Chris. That was great. Appreciate it. I'm Carrie. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. And we use a chip system here to mark your time in sobriety. First chip we want to offer is a white chip, surrender chip. Anybody want to give it up? Try this way of life? There she is. If you stay sober 30 days, look what you get. How's that? Hmm? Anybody needing a 30-day chip? This one is 9?
60.
60. We do 60-day chips. Oh, wow. Any more 60 days? What was 60 days ago? Big day. Okay. Okay, 90 days. You get a red chip. Anybody have 90 days? Okay. How about 6 months? 6 months. Yellow chip. It's very beautiful. Keep working toward it if you don't have it yet. Green one, 9 months. Anybody have 9 months? Okay. And does anybody have a birthday? Birthday today? I get to do a little announcement. This is Claire.
Hi, Claire.
She's an alcoholic.
This is from me.
Oh, thank you.
Congratulations.
Tell them how you did it.
Hey, I'm Claire. I'm an alcoholic. And this is Tim. One thing that when I came in here, I knew I was powerless. And That's one thing that I never, ever waver on. I know I'm powerless over this, you know. So that's one thing I never lose sight of. Another thing I did was got a sponsor, and the light really started coming on for me when that happened. I stay in close contact with my sponsor on a daily, you know, weekly basis, and that helps me a lot with my crazy head, because I still have a crazy head. I just have to work on it every day. I keep doing the same things that I did when I first came in, you know, not all perfectly by any means. Some of them, you know, they ebb and flow a little bit, but when they fall down, I pick them back up and I start doing them again. And the thing for me that falls down a lot is my prayer life. And when that falls down, I immediately know I got to start that back, because that determines how I feel. And I feel a lot better when I'm close to God. And one of the most rewarding things for me that I don't like doing the most, but it's the most rewarding, is sponsorship. I do that kicking and screaming, but when I do it, oh my gosh. You know, angels sing, and this stuff makes sense. And so that's all I've got. I'm grateful. Thank you so much.
Congratulations, Claire. Anybody else for a year or multiples? Has anybody really been thinking about it hard? Maybe want to come back and get this white chip? All right. Well, thank God for the chips you hold.
Good job. Good job, Karen. Congratulations to all the chip getters. Glad you got them. And congratulations on all everybody else's chips as well.
First I slip and then I crib to a hope-filled dream. Rescue me, and finally, waken there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Something that sets me free, and I love to a world in harmony. See love as a vision that one day. Take me where the promises are.